tonight on Arena. We remember the life and work of Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys and Laura Piani on her romantic comedy Jane Austen Wrecked My Life. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena and you can watch us on rte.ie/arena. Brian Wilson, co-founder, chief songwriter and creative force behind the Beach Boys, one of the most influential bands in American pop history, has died at the age of 82. Wilson was a musical prodigy known for his complex harmonies, innovative production techniques and emotionally resonant songwriting. He was the mastermind behind iconic albums like Pet Sounds and songs such as God Only Knows, Wouldn't It Be Nice and this. Good Vibrations, of course, from the Beach Boys, and playing that at the top of the programme tonight to remember Brian Wilson. The brains behind the Beach Boys and the brains behind the phenomenal music that we've just been listening to, even though it's only 2 minutes. John Maher rushed into studio to be with us this evening. Thanks so much for that, John. I mean, in the first whatever we played of that 3.5 minute song, I'd say maybe a minute and a half, we were already talking about the complexity of what Brian Wilson brought to the so-called lowly pop song.
Absolutely. Brian Wilson used to talk about the notion of the pocket symphony, that a pop song could have extraordinary complexity and depth and texture, and that you could utilise a studio in a spectacular way. Today, that's quite commonplace, that notion, the studio as instrument. But in 1967, when that song came out, it was revolutionary. And, you know, it comes a matter of months after Pet Sounds, an album that is still regarded as one of the greatest of all time. And of course, at the other side of the Atlantic, you have the Beatles and Abbey Road listening to this, thinking, how do we compete with this? How do we best this? So you've got this extraordinary sort of competition between two great bands from the 1960s.
Yeah, it's a big intercontinental competition that is
very much so.
Went on for a long time. And when we talk about Pet Sounds and what we're hearing there, how do you describe the style of what Brian Wilson did with a pop song, John?
I suppose symphonic, but with very much a West Coast sensibility, because in the early 60s, the Beach Boys were redefining what a pop song could be, and they were rooting it in their sort of Californian lifestyle. I mean, when you listen to Beach Boys from the 1960s, it's so evocative of blue skies and beaches and
had no
beautiful,
surfing, yeah.
Beautiful girls and suntans and open top cars, and the music kind of captures that. It's upbeat, even when the lyrics can be quite downbeat. There is a sense of kind of that you're of a forward momentum, and just the sheer catchiness of the music.
And it was essentially, the Beach Boys was a family affair, apart from one member who was a pal.
Yeah, it really was. And look, like a lot of families, it was quite challenging. Mm. You know, the creative genius was Brian Wilson, and his family had their talents, but it was him that all the pressure rested upon. And of course, their father, Murray, as was the case with so many fathers in music history, put inordinate pressure on Brian to come up with the goods. And it really was him that had to do this. And I think he struggled. I mean, today, again, we talk about sort of burnout and exhaustion that comes with being a young pop star, for instance. And often those young pop stars today don't have to write the material. They have to go out and perform it. But Brian had to basically invent music to push the envelope as far as he could. And I think he struggled with the mental health side in a spectacular way.
Yeah, there was a difficult relationship with his father.
Very much so.
And later on, there was a therapist, which was the subject of the film in 2015 that Paul Dano played Brian Wilson.
There was. I mean, it was, you know, Brian Wilson was the victim of a malignant therapist. And I suppose this was in the 1970s. 70s, a period, the so-called, as Tom Wolfe said, the me decade, and a sense where therapy really came into its own. But unfortunately, in that time, you had some very unscrupulous operators, and Brian Wilson was a victim of that.
Love and Mercy was the film, the title of the film I was searching there from 2015. We heard it in Good Vibrations that we played at the top there, John, this whole idea of the harmonies. I mean, the vocal harmonies that he puts in there and the rhythmic complexity that he puts into the songs.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the multi-part harmony is just something that is evocative and emblematic of the Beach Boys. And one could say that in music history, no band has managed to achieve the mellifluousness of what they did when they just had that those harmonies at play. And that's one thing we have to remember about this particular group. They all could sing so beautifully. And like so many perfectionists, of which, of course, Brian Wilson was one, they were ruthlessly efficient in the studio. They worked ferociously hard. They only wanted the very best material to ever emerge from that. So they really put in the hard yards in order to do it. But we can still hear it. You know, we're 60 years on, these songs still sound so incredibly fresh. Yes, they are of a particular place and time, but they still sound incredible.
The Pocket Symphony, you referred to it earlier on, John Maher, and there, God only knows, like, there's almost a second movement in that little phrase that we just heard.
There is a reminder that that was co-written with Tony Asher, a phenomenal songwriter from the time, in the style of a Baroque pop song. I mean, with Pet Sounds, it's the opening track on the second side of that album. The attempt of for that album to just have so much eclecticism, complexity, almost the aural equivalent of the great American novel.
Finally, John, you interviewed him. What kind of musician did you meet when you spoke with him? How long ago was that?
This is about 20 years ago when he released Smile, which was, of course, the
kind of renaissance after his second
indeed,
marriage.
I mean, Smile was supposed to follow after Pet Sounds, and then it was abandoned. And in rock history, it was perceived to be the greatest album that we never heard. And then it comes out. He was a very tender, vulnerable, fragile kind of person. He sometimes lost his train of thought, but there were also moments where he was lucidly back in the 1960s, and it was so exciting to listen to him.
Yeah, and what a legacy he has.
An extraordinary legacy. As long as people listen to music, the Beach Boys will always be there.
Here they are right now with Wouldn't It Be Nice. Wouldn't it be nice remembering Brian Wilson, whose death was announced at the age of 82. The Echoes Festival is heading into its 11th iteration in Dundalk, County Louth, hosted by Louth Contemporary Music Society. New York-based vocalist Daisy Press is just one of a number of musicians due to play at the festival. In recent years, Daisy has become known for powerful performances of the work of the musical and spiritual force that was the 12th century abbess Hildegard van Bingen. But Daisy had something of a rock and roll childhood. Both her parents were part of Neil Diamond's band, and they toured the world with the singer for over 40 years. And I think Daisy herself was on some of those tours. But before we get into all of that, Daisy, you told me earlier on, you were doing a sound check before we started the programme, when you heard about the death of Brian Wilson, you got goose pimples.
Yeah, I got goosebumps. I thought about him and I thought about his gifts. That was the first thing. And a gift, a very specific gift that came to mind right away was trying to figure out how his melodies actually go. So I started to think to myself, okay, how does it go? Like, da 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 da. See, I'm already lost, but it's like this
so complex.
It's so complex, but what a pleasure to leave this labyrinth behind for people to find their way through.
Yeah, and you, what a wonderful way to refer to it as a labyrinth in that fashion. And it shows the way you were picking through, God only knows there, that, you know, in fact, that pop sensibility has never left you. And it was ingrained in you in some ways, I guess, with those tours with your parents.
I had no choice. My mom was on stage. Neil Diamond music was pumped into the womb of my mother when she was on stage doing these shows every single night. And my dad playing the bass lines. He was the bassist. While I was going from a single-celled organism to something much more complex, which is like what I am now. So I really like to think these lyrics, these Neil Diamond lyrics and songs are in my DNA. I didn't have a choice.
And while on that, I believe there were some people there on that tour who kind of opened up the world to classical music to you too.
Yeah.
How soon, now you're a vocalist now, you have a Shruti box sitting on your knee.
Yes.
And I'm thinking as you were doing that weavy version of God Only Knows, I'm thinking of Hildegard van Bingen and the 12th century abbess, the spiritual and musical force that she was. You know, that type of winding labyrinthine melody is there too.
Exactly. And Hildegard had her own little signatures too. And she would jump octaves. She was writing for female voices and writing for this ecstasy in the voice, which will jump around and which will enter into this altered state where melody becomes like melismatic and floating. And I think that was in Brian Wilson's music. And I thought, you know, Hildegard, Brian Wilson, Hildegard, what interesting, weird, beautiful gifts they left for us. Thomas Merton in Care of the Soul talks about Hildegard, and he said she really left behind her sting, her gift for the world. And he named that as the do-do-do-do-do-do-do, which is how she begins a lot of her chants.
Yeah, and again, that could be God Only Knows in a different life.
Absolutely, and then modulating a few more times. Yeah. But she, you know, she did that too, so... Mm. So I don't know. I think it's fitting for their names to be mentioned in the same sentence.
In the same program and in the same sentence. You're going to perform a piece of Hildegard's for us. What is it?
Yes, it's O Virga Mediatrix, the branch, the mediating branch between the worlds. And of course, she's talking about Mary, but she's talking about this ladder, this labyrinth, this connection between the worlds. And it happens for her through the natural world, through trees. Yep.
Let us hear the music of Hildegard van Bingen.
Alleluia.
And so the Shruti Box fades off into silence. The voice of Dizzy Pressler performing live for us this evening on Arena with the music of Hildegard van Bingen. Dizzy is part of the Echoes Festival, hosted by the Louth Contemporary Music Society this weekend. That is an extraordinary piece of music, and the way he performed it, really phenomenal to be sitting opposite. I want to talk about some of the other pieces that you're going to be performing at the weekend too, not least of which was something I listened to today. I've heard Schubert's Winterreise several times. I'd never heard The Cold Trip Part 1 by the Austrian composer Bernhard Lang. I listened to it with guitar quartet. You will be performing that at the weekend as well.
Yes, I mean, it's just a dream piece, a dream group to be performing with. And Bernhard Lang is one of my favorite humans on earth and such a great mentor. I learned this piece, The Cold Trip, before ever really knowing Winterreise. Kind of like I knew the movie Spaceballs before Star Wars. But The Cold Trip makes such incredible sense to me in that it's like pop music. It's like a guy, it's like a boyfriend in his garage with a guitar that's slightly out of tune, singing songs about a girl that he can't have and repeating himself over and over and over. And I love the fact that a woman gets to sing this song cycle.
And as you say, it has that pop sensibility. That's what really struck me as I was listening to it this evening. And the other piece I wanted to mention is the contemporary Czech composer, Martin Smolka,
yes. Yeah.
Tell me about him and why his music speaks to you so much.
Oh, gosh. Well, both Bernhard Lang and Martin Smolka like a clean, pure sound where the voice is really inside of the mouth and the speech and language are a vital, integral part of their music. Martin Smolka writes music that at first glance looks, that'll be easy or simple. But then you realize how hard it is and what a rewarding challenge it is to approach something without affect, to sing something clearly, purely. Everything becomes big.
Yeah, and I know also that is a totally a cappella piece, and to hear your voice, it was nice with the Shruti Box, but to hear it by itself, I think, will be quite the treat. Simplicity is often the hardest thing to achieve, but that's what you will be doing. Thanks for coming into us this evening, Dizzy, and thanks so much for your performance.
Thank you so much, Shauna. I was delighted to be here and very excited to perform in this festival here this weekend.
That's Dizzy Press. And the Echoes Festival is where Dizzy will be performing. Dundalk, 13th and the 14th, with Dizzy's performance, Moon on the Sea, 3 p.m. With the Aleph Quartet at the Chapel in St. Vincent Secondary School. Full details of that and all of the events at the festival on louthcms.org. You're listening to Wednesday Night's Arena. We often complain that rom-coms give us woefully unrealistic expectations when it comes to the reality of what it is to navigate the vagaries of modern love. But in a new French film, the central character says j'accuse to a much earlier proponent of the idealised romance story. Jane Austen Wrecked My Life is the bilingual first feature from writer-director Laura Piani. The story is about Agathe, a bookshop employee and hopeful novelist who, like some of Jane Austen's heroines, is single, lacking in prospects and dangerously close to being past her prime. But a trip to an eccentric Austen-themed writing retreat forces Agathe to rethink. Let's listen to a clip from the film. Camille Rutherford plays Agathe. She's just arrived in England for this writing retreat and she is collected from the ferry by a tall, handsome stranger called Oliver, played by Charlie Anson. Unfortunately, her stomach gets the better of her.
Agathe Robinson, it's me.
Oh, sorry, I thought you'd be much older. I was asked to collect an elderly lady. I'm Oliver Lowe. I'll be driving you.
Is that your car?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, that's...
I must warn you about something. I'm really not comfortable when it comes to cars. It panics me to be in a car. My head is kind of spinning all of a sudden.
Are you all right?
I'm really sorry.
No, it's all right. These things happen.
Nice juice, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm fine.
There we have Camille Rutherford as Agathe and Charlie Anson as Oliver in a scene from the new film Jane Austen Wrecked My Life. Writer and director Laura Piani with me on the line this evening. It's not quite the meet cute moment that we might think of from most romantic comedies, Laura. I guess it's part of the expectation that you wanted to give us there. This is a modern take on the romantic comedy, but certainly echoing back to Jane Austen.
Good evening. No, it is not. It's the worst kind of meeting you can ever imagine. But that's what I like with rom-coms. You know, is that you can create your worst nightmares and laugh about it. And create tension between the two characters. It's probably one of the most important thing. And this scene is definitely create some distance between them.
It certainly does. If somebody meets you and vomits on your shoes, you're not going to be too happy. But I guess the title of the film itself, Jane Austen Wrecked My Life, Laura, it does suggest that you are a big fan, I think, of Jane Austen's. Yes. This year, of course, marks the 250th anniversary of her birth. How did you come to love her work? Because I think it has happened in stages throughout your life.
Yes, I discovered her when I was a teenager because I was an avid reader, but I really wanted to read any kind of romance. But it's just that I think I was too young to understand her humor and the political aspect of her work and her writing, really, the wit. So I rediscovered her when I was working as a bookseller, actually, at Shakespeare and Company in my 20s. And there I was ready. To read between the lines and to engage deeply with the political questions that she raised, like, you know, more than 200 years ago and that are still relevant today. And yeah. I think it's fascinating.
You mentioned that you worked in Shakespeare and Company, the famous bookshop, not just for its connection with James Joyce's Ulysses, but for many, many reasons. How romantic a place is Shakespeare and Company, that shop?
Oh, that shop is unique. Is probably unique for many, many people. It I think it's a weird thing, you know. It's a home for so many people in the world. Those who just came once, or who worked there, or who slept there, you know, because there is this tradition since the 50s, actually, that if you're a young writer and you want to live in Paris and you don't have money, you can sleep in the bookshop in exchange of a few hours of work per week. And this tradition has been kept. So it's more than a bookshop. It's a sanctuary for book lovers. It's a poetical place. It's a community. It's a very interesting place that I would suggest to visit.
Yeah, and indeed your character Agathe also works in that bookshop as part of the story that is told here. Jane Austen herself, is she in some ways the inventor of the romantic comedy? Is it the first romantic sense of a romantic comedy, or certainly a romantic novel that has a kind of a realism and a great sense of humour in underneath it when she wrote those novels?
Oh, I think she definitely paved the way. I think she understood that you could be entertaining, generous with the reader, and extremely political, and having she was ahead of her time because she has distance on the conventions and the absurdity of the rules of her world. And I think that's what I love about rom-coms. It's a genre that has been looked down a bit for many reasons by arthouse cinema, but it is a very political genre, because if you talk about love, if you talk about desire, if you talk about the other as a chance, not as a problem, you say a lot, actually, much more than when you're trying to preach.
Yeah,
I guess.
And to what extent has Jane Austen herself been looked down upon and, you know, has been the subject over years and years of great literary snobbery?
Yeah, I think she's snubbed by people who didn't read her. But I guess it's chic, you know, to categorize women writer as a girly writer. But I always remember Virginia Woolf, you know, paying tributes, saying that she is maybe one of the most important a British writer, but I think it says a lot about who are the people who say that more than about Jane Austen, actually.
Well, you have one of the main protagonists giving out about Jane Austen just a little bit in the car. We'll go back to the film, and this is another scene, but just shortly after the scene of the vomiting on the shoes. And we do find out the reasons for that later on in the film, why that panic comes over Agathe. But in this scene, we'll hear Agathe and Oliver once again. They're in the car. And like many of Jane Austen's leading men, Oliver certainly starts out as a bit of a snob, it has to be said. And here he is talking, probably mansplaining to Agathe, what is wrong with Jane Austen.
So have you been working a long time for the Jane Austen residency?
I'm Jane Austen's great, 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 great nephew.
Wow.
Yeah, my parents set up the Jane Austen residency, but I'm not really part of the fan club. I'm just helping out because my father recently lost his driver's license.
Right. And what do you normally do for a living then?
I teach contemporary literature at King's.
Sorry. You teach literature, but you despise Jane Austen.
I just think her work is a little overrated. She has a rather limited scope if you compare her writing to, say, Dickens or Shakespeare.
Do you know what the real problem is?
What?
Well, until Jane Austen came along, all female roles were solely written by men, and they were either portrayed as idealized perfection or monsters. Jane Austen made them human beings, that's all, even capable of humour.
Camille Rutherford as Agathe and Charlie Anson as Oliver there in a scene from Jane Austen, Wrecked My Life, and writer and director Laura Piani speaking to me about the film this evening and indeed about Jane Austen. And that's a stout defence of Jane Austen that comes from Agathe and I'm guessing would come directly from your mouth too, Laura.
Yes, yes. You guess well. Everything she says is something that I could say, I think.
I know, and it's desperately insulting sometimes to say how autobiographical, but, you know, you did go on several retreats, in fact, to the Jane Austen house, writing retreats to the Jane Austen house in England. You did work in Shakespeare and Company, and you are a writer, I know, across television and here as a screenwriter. Are there large parallels between her Agathe's story and your own story?
I think I didn't think about this film as an autobiography, but I think it is definitely a very intimate film because, yes, I've been working at Shakespeare and Company, and this character, this woman, is probably, you know, the she contains all the people, including me, but all the people I've been working with during these years. And I think you know, when you write a fictional character, you put so much about yourself, but so much about the people you love, the people you meet. So I'm pretty much as much Oliver and Fitz than Agathe, actually. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So it's not my story, but I deal with imposter syndrome. I do feel like I am on the edge of like being recognized as a terrible writer whenever I start to write. I do feel like literature is such a huge thing that it's very difficult to find anything to say. You know what I mean? All these things that I think are very relatable, either you write or not. But, you know, this imposter syndrome and this block that we all have. And that's why I love comedy. I think comedy is a remedy to live, you know, because comedy is exposing everything we're trying to hide all the time. The shame that we all carry with, you know, certain degrees, let's say. So that's what I wanted to explore with that film.
And Agathe, played by Camille Rutherford, compares herself to Anne Elliot in Persuasion, to that particular character. She also talks about, you mentioned the character of Felix there, And I think, isn't it Henry Crawford from Mansfield Park that she says he is a bit of a cad? This is the chap that a friend of hers, kind of, they have a type of a relationship going, but we're not sure. And I'm guessing Mr. Darcy must be at least one of the models for Oliver within all of this. Will fans and those knowledgeable of Jane Austen's work find lots of Easter eggs, not just in the characters, but in the plot of your film, Jane Austen Wrecked My Life?
Yeah, I wanted to do a generous film in the sense that I didn't want to address the film only to those who read Jane Austen, but I really wanted to play in a meta writing way, if I can say that in English, you know, where she inspired me, Jane Austen, as much as her books. And I wanted to play with the idea of who could be Jane Austen nowadays, you know, if she would be someone. So her books, her stories, her characters are pretty much everywhere, but I really wanted to make a film about a young woman who lives nowadays, you know, and who has this issue of feeling that she doesn't fit in the world as it is, as many people I know, actually. But she is still a 2025 young woman.
Yeah, and the other aspect of this, you mentioned how inspiring Jane Austen is to what you were writing, to the characters that we were writing, albeit in a very contemporary setup. I'm guessing there must have been films, and particularly romantic comedies or films with that a line within them, that were also influential in the making of this.
Oh yeah, I was. I mean, you know, when you do a romantic comedy, you have to pay tribute to a genre. So you come after so many amazing films. You know, my favorites are obviously the Richard Curtis ones from the 90s that are like incredible and like I can watch over and over again. But what was important for me was to do a film, a new rom-com, without being pretentious and trying to reinvent the genre, because I love this genre, but I didn't want to do a film about a young woman that is saved by a man or by love. I really wanted to say something else. I really wanted to make a film about a self-discovery journey of a young woman who dreams to be a writer. And because she's on that journey, she finds love too. You know, but that was really important for me to tell this kind of story.
Yeah, and that in fact she saves herself. There isn't some knight in shining armor who's going to come along and do that for her. Within all of that, I have to say your use of music within the film is very interesting. The big dance sequence in the beginning of the film, and a really pivotal point that I'm not going to give away within the writer's retreat, almost like a 19th century ball. very much so. The way you use choreography and the physical aspect of Camille Rutherford's and indeed other people's performances, very important to the film, I think.
Yes, but I was also looking for actors that were able to, I mean, Camille, she can carry, she can do slapstick, she can do physical comedy, but I didn't want a dancer. I didn't want someone who would be a perfect dancer, because I think what is so touching with her is that she doesn't dance well. She just dance, you know, and the opening scene is a dance scene where she dances alone and in a way that she couldn't do that if she was in front of anyone, actually. Yeah. And I think it was very important for me to say that sometimes when you are in a bookshop surrounded by books, it's the only place where you feel safe, where she feels safe, you know, and the whole journey of the film is to be actually able to dance with someone else at some point.
All right. Well, listen, I must say I enjoyed it very much, and it has a great French. It's in French, both French and English, and I know that had to do with funding. I think it's 70% French, 30% English. But it was a most enjoyable watch. Thank you so much for being with us this evening, Laura.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you so much.
That's Laura Piani. And Jane Austen Wrecked My Life will be in cinemas this Friday. We will be reviewing it on Thursday night's Arena. Composer Amanda Feary has long explored the landscapes of sound, blending acoustic instruments, electronics, voice and field recordings into her work. Her latest project is called Nest, and she says it's a meditation on the meaning of home, land and belonging. Ahead of the album's release on June the 16th and a live performance at Cork Midsummerfest on June the 18th, Amanda Feary joins me, a Feary rather, joins me in studio this evening. Nest was inspired by her creative collaboration with Emer Walsh and Eamon de Valera's famous 1943 speech, where he said things like this.
The ideal Ireland that we would have, the Ireland that we dreamed of, would be the home of a people who valued material wealth only as a basis for right living. Of a people who, satisfied with frugal comfort, devoted their leisure to the things of the spirit. A land whose countryside would be bright with cozy homesteads, whose fields and villages would be joyous with the sounds of industry, with the romping of sturdy children, the contests of athletic youths, and the laughter of happy maidens, whose firesides would be forms for the wisdom of serene old age. The home, in short, of a people living the life that God desires that men should live.
Eamon de Valera's 1943 radio address to the Irish nation and part of the inspiration for Amanda Feary's new piece, Nest. Who was listening to that particular speech or that particular clip and decided this is part of what we should use in Nest, Amanda?
Well, it was something I wanted to do for a long time as a project, and I'd heard a snippet of the speech years ago in a documentary, and I couldn't place the timing of it. And then when I went and kind of researched that it was broadcast whilst World War II was raging and the timing of it, and I looked into it further and listened to the rest of the speech. And I suppose there were certain elements of the speech that definitely provoked me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wanted to do something where the speech I think of as a sort of time stamp. And then there's this gulf of time between 1943 and present day, and to explore that gulf of time.
Yeah.
Where there's a lot of ideals in the speech, but if we look at present day contemporary Ireland and the reality, I suppose, of different social and economic issues.
In particular, I think, I mean, the aspect that struck me most in what you're exploring in Nest is even there in the term Nest. You're looking at this idea of home, home as a refuge, home as a place of solace, peace and security, not as an investment.
Yes, this idea of Nest as this ultimate place of comfort, but that, you know, I kept thinking of the term nest of vultures, nest of vulture funds, and, you know, that it's not exactly a safe, secure space. It can be a place of sanctuary, but it can also be a site of seizure as well, you know.
You've also referred to Nest as a type of mass.
Yes. Yeah. So I suppose how I see the album and how I see the performance at Cork Midsummer Festival next week is just this idea to kind of congregate and process and reflect. Mm. So the album, for example, doesn't have separate tracks. It's all one continuous play
piece.
Because I don't want a break in the album, and I don't want a break or any intervals in the performance either. So if we just take the religious aspect of Mass away, there are sort of common modes of congregating and coming together to process and reflect, like a vigil or a demonstration or a protest. Mm. Those elements are in common. So that's why I've been calling it a sort of a mass, in that we can come together in this musical space, not in the traditional sense of a mass, and kind of process things.
Yeah, and there are aspects of the composition, which I was listening to earlier today, the guitar and the electronics don't necessarily strike one immediately in terms of that title, but there's a large amount of organ, which you're playing organ, I think, on the recording. You'll be playing it in the performance as well. There's organ there, and indeed there's a choral sound there as well, the wonderfully named Four in a Bar, the quartet of singers. You sent us in a little clip from the piece, so let's have a listen. There we have the little clip from Amanda Feary's composition Nest with the libretto by Eimear Walsh. Amanda's with me in studio this evening. They come to make a ruin is that phrase, and it's repeated several times throughout the piece, Amanda. Where does that come from?
So that comes from the libretto that Eimear Walsh wrote as part of the vocal elements that you heard in that clip. There are from Four in a Bar, and we recorded this vocal quintet for Eimear's installation Romantic Ireland that was part of last year's Venice Art Biennale. So our coming together is a little bit earlier than that even, because I reached out to Eimear to ask them would they be interested in writing a libretto exploring this speech and sort of the different prompts that are in this speech. And then it came to Eimear coming to work on the installation for Venice, and they decided it'd be interesting to include an operatic soundtrack as part of this installation. So they got to work on this libretto. So that phrase that we hear there, they come to make a ruin, is part of a section of the libretto that even in my early sketches I had written down as Tenant's Prayer. The character in the libretto for the opera is a tenant on their deathbed, speaking to the men that are about to evict him on the night of the On Language in the Irish Nation speech in 1943.
Wow. Yeah.
So there are some choral elements from that piece that are part of this album.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about is the place of performance, or the venue at Cork Midsummer Festival, which is in St Finbar's Cathedral. That adds a certain potency and atmosphere to the whole thing, I would have guessed.
Yes, yeah, I'm really looking forward to playing it. Actually, the organ parts for the album were recorded in St Finbar's Cathedral last year. So I'm really happy to just get back there again and perform where the sort of last few bars of the album were recorded.
All right. And it's taking place in Finbar's Cathedral. The album releases on June the 16th and the live performance then is on June the 18th.
Yes, 8 p.m. Yes.
8 p.m. at St Finbar's Cathedral as part of Cork Midsummer Festival. And that is almost it for Wednesday night's Arena. Let me tell you before I go that sound supervision tonight was by James Feeney. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Research was by Leah Murphy and Paula Shields. And that the programme was produced by the incomparable Kay Sheehy. If you look at the RTE Culture website, you will see why she is called that.